We get to the business at hand. Our speaker in this series of law, order, and justice in times of turmoil is William H. Robinson, who presently occupies the position of Director of Registration and Education in Springfield, state capacity, a department which is concerned with, essentially, with the licensing and regulation of numerous professions and occupations. But for 3 years before that, Mr. Robinson was the director of the Cook County Department of Public Aid, an agency which I would imagine is probably among the top three, perhaps the largest, public agency administering public assistance in the country. Perhaps New York City agency is larger, I'm not sure. But in this capacity as director of public aid, involved in the administration of general assistance and all forms of public aid under the federally aided programs, as well as numerous social services in connection with the juvenile court, family service problems, our guest has had a very, very profound involvement in precisely the areas of concern with which we deal. I first met Mr. Robinson when he joined the state legislature in 1955 from Chicago. He was there on business of the public. I was there simply as a lobbyist for the Chicago Bar Association. But I got to know him quite well at that time and during the intervening years until the end of his service in 1965. He served with great distinction. I say this not simply as a matter of routine, introductory pleasantries. In fact, he was selected by the newspaper correspondents in his first session as the outstanding legislator in Springfield. The list of his associations in civic, professional, religious, social, and other communal activities and concerns is so impressive and so long that I think I'd simply exhaust too much time in reading them all. Let me simply conclude in my introduction by saying that there are very, very few people, really, in the state who, by virtue of a personal experience and a professional experience, have been more closely identified and concerned with so many problems of the poor and the law. Mr. Robinson comes to us by virtue of that experience with insights and perspectives which I am sure will be very, very instructive to us. I am very privileged to introduce to you Mr. William Robinson.
Thank you very much, Reuben. I almost said Wilbur. You know, I said to someone, the more I tried to think about today, the more I became convinced that I was the wrong person for this role. I'm not a lawyer, but I must confess I'm a law school dropout. I didn't have brains enough to be a lawyer. But I saw how lawyers operate even today at the table. Reuben read announcements that there were conditions, economic conditions, which would prevent you're having two cups of coffee. So I know this is the way he got his two cups. Legitimate, he didn't eat lunch. I said, I don't think I'm the proper person because there are quite a few lawyers around. And lawyers are very unhappy if you don't quote case titles and precedents and so forth. And I will not do much of that. And also, I think I should warn you, those of you who have in the past heard me talk, that I'm now the member of a governor's cabinet, part of an administration team, and sort of committed to a kind of policy of that administration. And I suppose I might not be as candid in answering some questions as I would have been if I were elsewhere. So you may have to read between the lines some of my answers. Having said that, the law and the poor. Ramsey Clark spoke to the National Conference of Social Work at the last session in Dallas on legal rights for all people. He quoted from France in his book, The Red Lily, and said, quoting, "The law in its majestic equality forbids the rich as well as the poor to sleep under bridges, to beg in the streets, and to steal bread." End of quote. Further, he said, in these words, France tells us that social justice is impossible where there is poverty. For this reason, those who would seek justice for all of our people must work to eliminate poverty. The first point I would like to stress is that the poor have always, and for many years and centuries perhaps, thought of the law as the enemy. I grew up in the South. My background is Southern. Notice I didn't say Deep South. It's because I come from Virginia. I didn't belong to the FFVs, but and there, the Southern heritage, the poor feared the law because they felt that the law was designed to keep them poor and to protect those who had against those who did not have. And if you were black, of course, it was designed to keep you in your place. And that there was no hope at the seats of justice. And therefore, one never went to a courthouse unless it was to pay taxes or to do an errand, because there wasn't justice there for the poor or for black people. There was always this unconscious fear for what the law would do to you in this Southern environment. Our parents would frighten us by saying, if you do not behave, we'll send for the sheriff. It was as if they were aping what the Roman mothers did to their children when they said, if you don't keep quiet, Black Hannibal will get you. When we talk about the poor in this country, the poorest of the poor, of course, are black people. When we talk about the law and the poor, we have to make a distinction between the law and the poor for the black poor and the other poor. The whole black experience has been that the law was made to keep a caste class system alive and vibrant. Fugitive slave law, the Dred Scott decision, even Plessy versus Ferguson. All of these were designed to keep the caste class system alive. And thus you can see that for the black poor, the law was the enemy. That there was a fear of a tyranny of the law. The escape from the rural South to the North did not much change this attitude and this feeling about the poor towards the law. Manifestations of this are seen in the way the law operates, manifests itself in the ghetto to the North, among the poor, and landlord and tenant relations, short waits, purchasing, contract buying, especially in the area of housing, installment buying, usury, I did not mention the automobile buying racket and the poor. And as an ex-legislator, oftentimes a reformer was terribly frustrated by the lawyer in his attempt to help the poor. And I would sometimes wonder whether the lawyer as a legislator was a legislator, or was he a special pleader for some interest? The point I'm trying to make here is that the poor have thought of the law as being uncongenial to the interests of the poor, that they would not seek justice. Law was not concerned with justice for them. That the law was designed to protect the status quo, was to keep things as they are, to protect those who have, and to keep the have-nots in the position where they would not be threatened, would not be threatening to change the thing. That the very nature of law was to frustrate social change, to frustrate reform, and thus inimical to the interests of the poor. Now, having said that, I think we are living today, I think we have seen also some change. We see change in this attitude. The growth of the legal aid movement has brought change in this attitude. But you know how inadequate the legal aid movement is in terms of the volume of need for its services. And I think one of the healthy things about the legal aid movement has been the recent marriage of the legal aid movement with the Bar Association. And also, I think the work of many
men in the bar association, I referred to this later on, in the bar associations, in behalf of the indigent persons and the law. The growth of the public defender movement. I spent many of my early casework days in the boys' court in Chicago, working for the Church Federation of Greater Chicago, the boys' court section. So I was counseling delinquent boys. And we had a public defender. And there was, and part of the folklore of the boys' court was, if you want to go to jail, let the public defender defend you at the bar. So when I would go back to the lockup to talk to boys before trial, sometimes the first request they would make would be, Mr. Robinson, will you keep that public defender quiet? I don't have any money for a lawyer, but I don't want him. Why don't you talk for me? I said, but look, I'm just a social worker. He said, but the judge will listen to you. That man will mess me up. Well, as a matter of fact, the man who was a public defender in those days in the court was a very dedicated young man. He's now a judge and a very good one, who really made many lawyers look, many of the state's attorneys look silly, because he was dedicated and he was in a training stage and he helped many, many boys. They didn't understand this, of course. And of course, some of them were so guilty, nothing could help them, you know. But the growth of the public defender movement, the fact that we can get county appropriations now for the public defender, and the enlargement of the public defender staff, and the continuity of staff people on public defender staff, so not only in Cook County, but across the country. All of this has added to not only the dignity of the law, but it has added to an emerging trust of the law by the poor, by the indigent offenders who come to court. Until now, many times I've had people to call me and ask if you can tell me how I may get in touch with the public offender. See, this is a long way from saying, don't let the guy talk for me. Now they see him as a lawyer and a friend in the court. And this is another aspect of the law that has increased its status among the poor. And that is the use of the law by agencies like the NAACP. Agencies which have used the law in the struggle for the achievement of civil rights, for fighting for the rights of those who have no money but who have picked up their cases, that use their cases as test cases which would help the individual but be the broadly based cases which would help a whole class of individuals and would help to move forward the whole question of civil rights. And the same is true with civil liberties. But the greatest thrust forward has been the community legal services on the OEO. And when OEO is dead, and I fear it's on its way to interment, this will perhaps be its most significant contribution, that it attracted dedicated young lawyers, that it attracted many men, and many of them, as I have observed, who came from affluent families, who found a new meaning for life in their defense of the poor, and they are trying test cases to break down barriers which kept people locked in the poverty range. Of course, some of them were irritants to me in some of my former jobs, but they were helpful. I A few days ago, I went to a drugstore to make a purchase. The young man said, "Hi." I didn't recognize him. So many young men who are scholarly these days wear extra accretions of hair on their faces that I didn't distinguish him. But he reminded me that he was the lawyer, a man who had been in my office when they were preparing the case that they took up to the appellate court that knocked out residents in Illinois. And I must plead guilty. I was there. I was not a very reluctant defendant in that case. As a matter of fact, I perhaps helped them to get the kind of case that would stick. This is what I mean. In other words, whereas in the past, I think this is a significant point, that we've seen the poor begin to embrace the law, as the law itself has moved to help the poor, the attitude of the poor towards the law has changed as the law has become productive in helping the poor to achieve rights for them, where in those cases where they would not have been able to achieve them if they had to pay counsel, for they had no fees. And then the legislation which has been passed, such a legislation as the FEPC, the struggle for open occupancy, and the involvement of lawyers in these struggles, and the exposure of the lawyer to the mass groups, and the explanation, interpretation of emerging legislation to masses of people, to church groups, to ministerial associations, to groups of poor people who would never see a lawyer otherwise than they would come to plead for to explain these kind of causes. This has popularized the so-called popular lawyer who joins himself with unpopular causes to fight for the poor. This has given the poor a new image of the law, a new image of what the law can do for him. Housing, a few days ago, the American Civil Liberties Union won a tremendous decision. I was very gratified because it validated for me something I have been saying for 10 years, namely that the Chicago Housing Authority was the greatest agent for housing discrimination in the city of Chicago. This made me very unpopular in many circles, very unpopular. Some people did a lot of things to me because of it. They called me all kinds of party names. but it was a fact, and this has dignified, I mean, the law for poor people. I think that's forced this agency. And I know that there are many members on the staff of CHA are as happy as I that this happened. But they were victimized by a political system, and I know some very powerful politicians in the city who wouldn't dare say this, but who are happy that they won this decision because they've been held down by a few, I call them landlocked aldermen. Now they're free. The court has said so. Poor people were the defender, weren't they? Poor people sent these cases into the court. And the law, I mean, Civil Liberty Union took them up. They've won it. Already they're now discussing, you see the paper this morning? They're discussing now the location of low-income housing in suburban Cook County. Prior to this, why, this was blasphemy against the Holy Ghost. This means, and this is, and of course, this gives a new image of the lawyer, a new image of the law. The law now comes to help. The law is helping. Let me hurry on before I must get to my own field. I have here a a Supreme Court document, case Reuben King, Commissioner of the State Department of Pensions and Security, State of Alabama et al., appellants versus Sylvester Smith et al. This was a case that went up from Alabama on the man in the house rule. In Alabama, this whole welfare area. You know, the poorest of the poor in this country are welfare people. And here are many lawyers, many young lawyers have interested themselves in welfare legislation and in helping welfare people achieve their rights. And believe it or not, they have rights. Some people don't think so. Welfare unions. And there are also such things as welfare unions. About 2 years ago, I was on a radio program with a very distinguished novelist. And I said that I favored the organization of welfare unions. And the gentleman said, "You mean you favor welfare recipients organizing unions?" I said, "Of course." Well, it almost destroyed the man's composure. I said, they are American citizens. They're being poor in no manner disturbs their civil rights. They have a right to organize. It says writers organize. It says the newspaper guild is an organization. They have as much right to organize as you newspaper people. Or as you radio and television people. They have a right to organize for their best interests. I said, and they perhaps are less vicious in some of their organization than you are. Many lawyers have helped welfare unions. I know Wiley, who organized the welfare rights movement in this country. I know that many of the regulations that went into the amendment, Reuben, of the current Social Security Act grew out of what lawyers have been doing and suggesting to staff at Health, Education, and Welfare. An example, of course, is the appeal system that provides that July 1st of this year, in the public assistance category, that the welfare recipient not only will have the right to appeal if a grant is denied, but that the grant will stay, and if an appeal is made, the grant will continue during the period of appeal, and the public welfare agency must pay for the lawyer who handles the case for the welfare client. Well, of course, the Resurrection City helped to make that, helped to sort of solidify that, but lawyers helped to get this into the mill. This case, the man in the house rule. Lawyers worked hard on this case. And this was, you know, this is the case in which, in Alabama, if a woman had children and the home was deemed to be unsuitable, if she cohabited with a man in the house or outside the house, she was deemed to be an unsuitable mother. And therefore, she was ineligible to receive ADC funds. This case went up, and of course, it was declared that this violated the basic rights of this woman. I understand that some constitutional questions were not covered in this, but at least thousands of cases and thousands of people were given public aid because of this decision. Then I went down, and I was down in New Orleans at a welfare forum, and I asked two administrators in two southern states, after this decision had been rendered in HEW, they issued orders to bring these people under the umbrella of the decision, if they had begun to do this, and finally, after much questioning, they frankly said they hadn't done it because they hadn't gotten orders from their politicians. But those were law and order states. Here in Illinois, we have a law that I use quite frequently in the area of housing, that if a building does not meet the code and welfare recipients reside there, the welfare administrator may withhold rents until the building comes into compliance. The law was amended to provide that the landlord could not cut off the water or the electricity or do anything to make it uncomfortable. And so while administrator, I withheld thousands of dollars worth of rent. And of course, and the mere withholding was a defense, I guess I'm saying it right, against eviction. Would you be amazed that there were certain judges in Chicago who, under the proper stimulus, would evict my people? Then when I went on television and called their names, I made a few more enemies. It was amazing what, then you see, the poor of Chicago began to see that the law was fighting in their behalf. What happened? That complaints began to pour in about my house. Landlords, of course, began to pour in complaints too. I'm trying to make the simple point, I'm trying to say very simply, that the evolution of the law in this time of social change, in this time of revolution, that the evolution of the law itself, in response to the historic currents flowing through our times, this evolution has caused the poor to get a new idea and to get a new image of law and a new attitude towards the law. Of course, in the area of criminal law, there has been, in the conferences, bail bond reform. This primarily has helped the poor. The strengthening of public defender agencies. Again, the community action concept in OEO and the community action agencies that with legality, with legal resources and legal resource programs, the consumer fraud campaigns and crusades, the reorganization now going on in the Attorney General's office, in the Consumer Fraud Department, I think will again highlight the fact that government itself and in this legal branch is now beginning to use the law as a friend of the poor. In my new job, of course, I have more to do with lawyers than I really like. There's a great opportunity there for lawyers to help me with the poor, because much exploitation goes on. And it's amazing to see, I found some very dedicated men who've been there at the heart of things, battling away with the law to rescue the poor from exploitation situations. I've been very much encouraged at what I have observed, many young lawyers and young law students, namely their dedication to this whole business of crusading for the poor with the law. Years ago, I heard Morris Ernst speak to a group of young lawyers who were at that time, he had finished a study on 25 campuses of large universities, where he had been visiting law schools, He was making a report to a group of young lawyers interested in civil liberties. And he said something. I was not a lawyer, I just happened to be there. But he made a statement that I shall never forget. Never forget him as a man in the first place. And then the fervor with which he said it. And he was an old man then. But the vitality he communicated to those who heard him. He said, it is your business, saying to the older men, to keep alive the fire that burns in the bellies of the youth in the legal profession in this generation. And I think if this tradition continues, that the poor will not see the law as the enemy, but they will see the law as their friend.